This is Edward Zwick, and I'm going to be looking at a print of The Last Samurai now, just on days after it's been released. So much of it is very fresh in my mind. Most of what's fresh in my mind is the despair and the frustration and compromise that one feels when you're actually trying to make a movie, and only now am I beginning to enjoy the fruits of that and the experience of seeing an audience see this. The truth is that every movie you make, there's really two movies. There's the movie, the story of the movie, and there is the story of your experience, and often they mirror one another and reflect in an interesting way each on the other. In this case, it's the story of someone not of a culture, journeying into that culture and trying to learn as much as I can, as he can, that was me, and to respect it as much as I can, and yet also appropriate it to a certain degree for the sake of a Hollywood film. And to that end, I'll try to talk about those places in which that succeeded and those places in which I think we fell short. We begin with the character of Katsumoto, who's played by Ken Watanabe, who really is, in fact, the moral center of the film. When I found Ken first, I had Tom Cruise and a script and a lot of money, but no film. I think we all felt that without Ken, without the character of Katsumoto, rather, there would have been no film. Even the kanji here for the title of The Last Samurai is an interesting illustration. There were many conversations about what kanji looked appropriate to period, what looked beautiful to various aesthetics, and like everything in the film, it was subject to a kind of scrutiny and conversation. And here is the first reveal of the character of Nathan Algren, and the idea of putting him backstage with all this Americana is that the film begins on July 4th, 1876. That is, in fact, America's centennial. 100 years, it's 100th birthday, its emergence as an extraordinary power after the Civil War, and just days after the massacre at the Little Bighorn. This confluence of events was very important to us, I think, because we wanted to talk about an America that was beginning to have its power felt in the world. The imperialist impulse was just beginning. America had come to the Philippines. We'd become arms merchants to the world as we had developed this extraordinary technology in the Civil War. And the character of Nathan Algren is a man who's been a man of his time. He'd been at West Point. He'd been in the Indian Wars. And he's now actually reduced, as many former generals to this day are, to working for a military-industrial complex, selling, chilling even those weapons to the rest of the world. We found a wonderful consultant at West Point, an historian, who turned us on to diaries of the men who had fought in those Indian wars. It turns out the class of West Point of about 1860, probably 60 or 70% of those men published memoirs. They were all very learned, very literate men. And of the memoirs of those men who went west to fight with Custer and others, they were broken down into a very interesting set of behaviors. I'll get back to those men in a second, because I want to talk for just a moment about what Tom is doing here. This kind of overacting, the kind of period Del Sarte behavior, was, I felt, very important that we do what we could to get past the contemporary perception of Tom Cruise, the movie star. So for him to take a set of these large behaviors, I thought was one of the ways that we could begin to accomplish that. Tim Spall, who plays the character of Graham, helped us in that a lot, because he's rather academic in his understanding of what Henry Irving might have done at its time. It's almost as if we were trying to accomplish a very presentational style that was antithetical to the internal experience as you see it begin to emerge here as he goes off the script, as it were. I think it was very important to Tom that the character of Algren seem volatile even while he was in despair. Someone who might do anything at any time. There's a danger with an actor playing someone who's haunted in this particular way, of becoming sort of lugubrious, even self-pitying. And it was, his intent and ours too, to try to avoid that. So we found these ways in which he was beginning to try to act out that self-destructiveness. In this case, by actually firing that gun in that theater, it was a sort of expression of that rage in a way, and trying to present a character who you don't necessarily know what he's going to do one moment to the next. There are people that I know who are like that when they're drunk. There are many different kinds of drunks. There are those who become sentimental and maudlin. There are those who become quite quiet. There are those who actually become quite volatile. And we thought that was probably more the nature of who this guy might have been. We go outside. We're at Burbank now. We're in the little corner of the old New York street. And this is Billy Connolly, who, you know, is a remarkable comedic actor, but has also shown us in Mrs. Brown what his dramatic work can be. It's not unlike Victor McLaughlin, which is a Scotsman playing an Irishman, and I suppose I'd always wanted to hear the words Captain Darlin' again in a film, as John Ford had done it many times before. It's a very beautiful mat that they put together rather quickly here, actually, of San Francisco. It was a lovely coincidence to discover that the cable car had just been introduced only a year or two before our story took place.
Sit down, please.
We now introduce other characters in the film. We introduce Tony Goldwyn and Masato Harada. Masato is a very eminent Japanese director in his own right, whom I met when I first began to go to Tokyo. I met him at a dinner party, and as I continued to meet other Japanese actors, none of them seemed to have the remarkable sense of comfort with English that he had. And I felt that was very important, to distinguish him with that familiarity and comfort from the character that Ken Watanabe plays, from many of the others in the film. He was not entirely thrilled with the idea of acting. He'd never done it before. He was quite nervous to begin, but as we began to work together, he did cotton to it, and he was a delight to have two directors here. Tony Goldwyn, of course, is a talented director in his own right. So to have other directors there around is actually quite comforting to a director or two, because they sympathize with your problems.
So, who will we be training your boys to fight?
His name is Katsumoto Moritsu. He was once
now, teacher. This moment here, when we actually hear the Japanese, is very important, because it suggests that their intelligence and their understanding is actually in some ways more sophisticated than those who they're dealing with, and that sort of starts strikes a note in the piece that I think is very important. Tom's laugh that comes up here is a very interesting choice, because again, it's a more acted out sort of derision and almost a kind of uncontrollable impulse that I think is a little bit upsetting to look at. It's not funny. It feels to me, full of contempt and self-loathing, even as he's laughing. It's not someone who enjoys things. He's laughing at the horrors. I think it's a sort of maybe a kind of defense mechanism for him. And again, it suggests a facet of the character here. I think we hope draws you in rather than keeps you out. We begin here in this scene, this extraordinary look of the interiors that John Toll photographs, this very classic feeling of gaslight, a very directional source light in the red damask interior that Lily Kilver has designed.
You want me to kill Japos? I'll kill Japos.
This moment, when Tom says, "You want me to kill Japos?" I think is a kind of a credo. It in one speech summarizes, where he begins, and the whole premise of the story of this kind is that someone beginning at this point ends at a point as far from where he began as we could ever imagine and never would have thought possible. That ship there is a CG ship. This is a blue screenshot of the sky. And so too is this shot of Fuji coming up, a creation, you know, based on a real photograph, but we've animated it as the mist clears as he sees what awaits him.
I have been hired to help suppress the rebellion of yet another tribal leader.
The prop here of the bag, of the beaded bag, is very important because we try to identify some bit of the past that he's carrying around with him, and Dave Gulick and the props in this are so thoughtfully rendered. The journals written by hand, little sketches that Algren makes, the idea that he would put on this uniform for the first time and that might summon the ghosts of the past. The beginning of the flashbacks were again, an interesting set of problems, how to do something in a very fragmented, almost imagistic way. We ended up doing some tests. We shot at 8 frames per second and then triple printed everything to try to give that slowed, strobing feel. Here, another large mat. You know, photoreal with using real elements, but again, that's a green screen shot trying to get the sense of scale as he's coming into this new place. But as we go to the harbor, there's a little extension on that map, but that's a set that we built in New Zealand, in the docks of New Plymouth. The idea of trying to keep that feeling of urbanization that you'd felt in San Francisco and suddenly discover that it's there in Japan as well, the whole attempt was to create the modern, feel the combination of old and new, people in European dress, Japanese in European dress, Europeans, peasants, rickshaws combined with steam from locomotives, geishas, all of it somehow trying to get the collision of the two cultures there within the images so that they exist with a kind of tension on screen rather than necessarily having to talk about it all. I'm not sure even one listens to Tim's words here as you see the scene. It's very hard to know how much exposition anyone can ever really listen to when one begins looking at a movie. I think you are struck more by the juxtaposition of images and trying to figure out the relationships more than the backstory. Here, as we pan up, we go from a real street to a painting of the palace. Now we're actually in Kyoto, walking up the steps of a temple. Throughout the film, we're trying to weave construction in Burbank, real locations in Japan, and construction in New Zealand, often within the same scene. Those steps are real. The temple at the top of it is from Japan that we've now added onto that shot. This is the imperial throne room that Lily Kilvert has designed. It's very beautiful, trying to get the formal feel. What was remarkable to us as we began to do our research was discover how actually decorous and tasteful these rooms were. They were not grand. There was a real humility to the imperial family. Also, by the way, the idea that the emperor would be in shadow and not seen is based on the real old imperial throne room in Kyoto that we visited. But the idea that the rooms were of a modest scale is true to much of the Japanese architecture of the day. It wasn't as if the huge royal imperial palaces of Europe. Rather, the emperor was a figure who needn't have that splendor because it was understood that he had the support of everyone and he wasn't at risk. He was protected by all of the samurai daimyos around him, so he needn't necessarily have to be, you know, guarded in quite the same way. The actor, as he emerges in this shot, is an actor named Chichinoke Nakamura, whose father is a very famous kabuki actor, and he himself is a kabuki actor. Yoko Narahashi, who helped me with the casting, and I felt that some of these kabuki actors, because their lineage goes back generations, would have that almost strange and wondrous feel of what royalty is over time. And that's why we chose him. He also looks, as you begin to look at pictures of what the real Meiji Emperor was, he looks quite remarkably like him. He was a young man who had not yet found his voice, who went on to become one of the most important rulers in the history.
Right, you little bastards! You will stand up straight or I will personally shit-kick every...
And now we begin what is, in genre films, a pretty classic moment, the idea of training the troops. I've even traded on myself. I did something not unlike it in Glory. It's different, though, because it's trying to lead to the revelation of Algren and his self-destructiveness. And the idea that he is a skilled leader, but in some sense disaffected, is very much at the heart of what we're trying to accomplish here. The training of these troops all had to be done in the ancient tactics in the appropriate way. A man named Jim Deaver and Dan King learned these tactics, taught these tactics to contemporary Japanese men who had... we had to fly from Japan to New Zealand. We had to house, we had to train, we had to entertain, attend to special medical or dietary needs in a small little oil and gas town in an unfashionable part of New Plymouth, unfashionable part of New Zealand. And what was remarkable is how willing they were day after day. They really believed in what this enterprise was and were quite eager to actually take anything we could dish out in the rain, in the sun. The scene is taking place in a cricket pitch in New Plymouth. And we felt it was very wonderfully odd with those tiers of green benches on which they would watch, and that it felt like a place that may indeed have existed in its day someplace else. There was an interesting challenge in the piece having to do with the character's cultural assimilation and the idea that he might once have been involved as a liaison to tribal leaders, and that he may once have actually, that he in fact was a linguist, was subtly very important to try to sell the idea that once he found himself in an alien situation in a Japanese village, that he might apply himself to trying to learn some Japanese. That's always a challenge in any piece, the idea of how not to have people who wouldn't ordinarily speak English to actually speak English. As far as the character that Harada plays, named Omura, there were many delegations of Japanese who were sent to America to learn English between when Perry came in 1854 and now in 1876. And many of the samurai leaders themselves had tutors, and they felt it very important, it became very fashionable to actually try to learn English as part of the idea of becoming competitive with the West. The notion that we would talk about scalping here, I felt was as if a kind of trigger to the Algren character, that to evoke that moment, and to evoke what he might have seen, would allow him to begin heading backwards, which sets him up for the very next scene when he wants the man to shoot at him.
Quick jerk. On the turf of your hair to release any clinging particles.
There initially was a notion of a scene that preceded this where he had actually seen the samurai and seen them in the street, but we decided to omit that.
Mr. Graham. How soon can you translate those books?
I think that Tom's darkness here is very, very, very well done. As he becomes internal, I think it lets us go into the sequence that we're going to, which is the flashback, and sets up where we're about to go in the next scene. It's a very different performance for Tom Cruise. There are not many words. We've taken away his the famous grin and the charm and the sort of avidity of his performances for which he's become rightly famous, and I think he was as interested as I was to go there, that to do less, to have it happen in his eyes, behind his eyes, as he is overcome by memory and in fact in some sense unable to speak for the weight of the memory. This massacre here that we're describing is actually based on a true massacre that Custer perpetuated called Washita, the Washita River, where they just exactly this horrible punitive raid on a man named Black Kettle, who came out to even greet them, carrying an American flag, and Custer decided to kill them all as a reprisal for having strayed from the reservation. Brutality of him and those wars is you know, known now, but you know, not certainly still well worth reminding ourselves. It was important for us to show that he was a teacher, that he'd been a real officer, that he knew, you know, what it was like to train men. Even in the midst of one's despair, one keeps doing one's job. But this moment coming up is an opportunity, again, to act out something which otherwise might just be latent or done with exposition. The idea that he would put himself in some, you know, horrible situation in harm's way to demonstrate a point is the kind of death wish that Katsumoto sees and is fascinated by, even in the battle. This ferocity, this willingness to stay and fight that he does later when in the next scene when they are attacked.
I beg your pardon? Tell this man, if he does not shoot me, I will kill him.
Captain, if I might have a warrant.
This young actor does a lovely job. There were many very small parts you'll see next to this young actor. I don't know his name. Lieutenant, I realized at the end of the movie there was a great need for a very important cameo by an officer, mostly anonymous up to this point in the Army. And I'm already setting that character up here in this scene. He'll become important in a moment. This is a scene which horribly had to be shot over 3 different days. Every time we begin to shoot the scene, it would get rained out. We had to keep coming back to it and break the intensity and break the continuity. And that becomes particularly difficult. And now we come to a sequence which was a source of some consternation to the studio because we built this entire village only to burn it down. And it's a tough conversation when you describe to your partner that you're, in fact, designing a whole and building something beautiful only to destroy it in a single shot. But they understood its implications and how important it was to understand the consequence of the coming of the modern, the coming of the railroad. And the truth is they were remarkably... remarkably respectful and, in fact, deeply invested in what we intended at all moments, because it was a huge risk to tell this story. And I was constantly surprised by how deep their understanding went and how they were prepared to back it up.
As soon as you can get rid of the samurai, well, yes.
How do you intend to find Katsumoto?
Don't worry,
Mr. We now head toward the first large-scale action piece, which we call the Battle in the Fog. And it was based on some reading that we had all done about the samurais, their use of weather as tactics. How could a group armed without weapons take on a group with weapons? That becomes a challenge in many scenes in this movie. In this case, they're counting on the lack of training, lack of preparation of these troops, and their ability to intimidate them. This set is a... third or fourth growth forest in a little gully in outside of New Plymouth. They were about to cut it down, harvest it, because it's a growth industry, lumber. And we found it and asked them, rather than cutting down, to let us lease it for a period of time, and that we would only cut down those trees that we needed, and so as to create a set within it. Those are ponga trees, intermittent with those pines. So essentially it became a set. We piped it all the way around. It's very difficult to keep fog in any particular area, that low line mist particularly. So there were plastic tubing of fog there are fans at every different time because the wind would, of course, shift and then you'd suddenly lose the fog from one moment to the next. Up in the trees, John Toll and the Grips had hung a huge, huge reflectors they were like blacks to black out the sun so as to keep the direct sun off of the set, and it looked almost like a huge ship up in the trees above us, and it may be certainly the largest set that any of us had ever worked on, because it was, you know, a real place that suddenly became a controllable place. The image coming up here, when they look and first see the samurai as they emerge from the fog, really is at the heart of where the movie began in my mind. The image of these creatures, almost medieval-looking, in this armor, in these terrifying silhouettes as they emerge, was very much in my imagination. And there are those rare moments when something that you photograph actually exceeds your imagination. This is a shot that we tried to get for 2 weeks to get it right, to understand the focal length, to understand the light, to make it right, to get the chats right. And we kept going back and back and back to try to get this shot. And then when we got it, it was worth all the trouble, because it's almost signature for the movie to me. Then, of course, the notion that they fire too soon, giving the samurai the edge that they needed, allows what next happens, which is essentially just a slaughter. That was the way in which this battle would be different. It was a rout. And there's shots here which are actually comp shots. You can't have horses ride at men that closely. You'll see coming up a shot just about now. That shot could never have happened. That's a composite shot of horses riding toward men. We did it two different times and brought them together. But even these horses riding next to these stuntmen is a remarkably difficult thing for horses to do. And the horses had to be picked and trained 9 months before by these extraordinary horse masters from England, Pete White and others, and these riders from Spain, because they don't want to hit men. They don't want to work around explosions and smoke and gunfire. And the falls that the horses do, which are so extraordinary, are all something that they learn to do, each horse individually falling to the right or to the left. Now here Tom Cruise is fighting at times on a real horse and at times on an animatronic horse. You know, the safety element of putting an actor in this very difficult situation is extreme. And the notion of having to actually wield a sword and fight as there's a rearing horse, that's the animatronic that rears at that point, and then we see him on a real horse and then back to the animatronic. But the stunt that's coming up of the rearing horse that gets hit by another horse is, of course, impossible to accomplish in life without extraordinary risk and probably fatality. So he rears, and that's hit by a fake horse hitting an animatronic horse. That horse rearing on the ground like that and is, in fact, not real. That's controlled by puppets, controlled by extraordinarily talented puppeteers. And now what we've tried to accomplish with Tom here is just the absolute ferocity. This is the thing that Katsumoto sees, the idea that this man is the fulfillment of this prophecy that he had seen in his meditation, in his dream. As he sees his mon, which is the tiger, now wielded by this stranger, it's the idea that there is some destiny, some unknown, inexplicable cause for him to be left there on this field. It's also really the very real beginning of Ken Watanabe's performance. And his face says more than any words ever could. It's also a moment where Hans Zimmer's score and the use of the shakuhachi becomes a kind of a signature for that samurai feel. Now, the man coming up to kill him now is wearing the red armor. The idea that he ends up killing this man who was going to kill him becomes quite important in the piece, almost, if you will, as a kind of a ghost story. The idea that this man whom he kills becomes central in his life as he almost is haunted by this figure and eventually even becomes this figure as he becomes father and husband and central to the family that he's now widowed. The next scene, the idea of showing the first seppuku and to do it in a way that was beautiful, ceremonial, and yet, if I could dare use the word tasteful, was a challenge. And the idea that it's seen from his point of view gave me the solution to how to do this. But remarkably, these Japanese actors doing a scene like this were very, very, very moved and very aware of its implications. It's not a scene that is taken lightly or ever done lightly by a culture to whom it's been central. The idea of moving behind the tree was the problem solving that I think also makes you feel inside Algren's sort of mysterious experience of what's happening, and yet tries to hold on to the ritual. We now go from various shots as we try to establish the location. That's New Zealand with Fuji added in the background. These are passes in New Zealand, which in fact are un-Japanese, and I think maybe distressing to some Japanese to think that they don't know where those mountains are in Japan. But this reveal of the village is, again, a shot that had been in my mind for a very long time. The idea that the riding in to this place begins the second act of the movie. And this begins what is, I think, John Toll's triumph in this film, which is the creation of a place that is indeed also a character. That it's a place that evokes something lost and something ending. The light on this particular day, you'll see in a moment, was so remarkable. You'll see these low-lying clouds there, and that's the shot with the light bouncing around under it. It looks as if it were done on a computer, but indeed it was natural.
What is your name?
We're also seeing Nyla Dixon's work here, the armor. Each one, each armor imagined for each character, revealing different aspects of their character. Also, Lois Burwell's work in Tom's makeup, the dissipated bloodshot eyes, the blood vessels, the idea of trying to beat him up in such a way as to then give him someplace to go as his character actually comes back to health and connection.
The winter is coming. You cannot escape.
Charlie Good.
She does the same for Ken. When you see Ken Watanabe in life, he has a much lighter, youthful regard than he has in this film. She gives him the weight of those bones and the eyes. This shot is just so beautiful. It looks almost like a Caravaggio. Tom lying there with her knitting. We wanted the reveal of her in the movie not to be an overly romantic one. We wanted it just to be, in some sense, not prettified. John deliberately lights her from below, uplights her, puts the shadow side in the foreground, and it's as if it's what he sees. I do like the sequence coming up here of the doors as they close. First, Ken, again, here's the bag, and those journals become important not just to justify the use of the journals as a kind of connective tissue in the piece. Now, those are the real monks back at the monastery. We're back at the monastery now. It was important, of course, to get passage of time and weather in the piece. So, you know, it rained so much in Japan, we wanted it to rain a lot in the village. And, of course, each night we had to create it. But this sequence here, the idea that he's outside of a life, that he's disconnected, that as he wakes, he looks, and he sees, he hears something and then sees something he hasn't seen much of in his life since he was a child, which is this family. And the people keep shutting him out. They keep closing doors on him. And he becomes aware of it increasingly as he looks now and sees this domestic moment of the family at dinner, which is in some sense more voyeuristic and private than, you know, if you were seeing people, say, dressing. And then she comes in a very beautiful way of kneeling with her left hand across and closing the door again. We go now to the first scene, all in Japanese, which is, it's you know, deliberate that we're saying that there's a life that goes on outside the protagonist. And we see these actors acting in their native language, and we understand something more than the protagonist is given cause to understand. We also begin to understand the relationships between them, between the son, the father, and his lieutenant. The character Ujo represents for me a strain in Japanese culture at the time. It was called Sono Joy, which means honor the emperor, death to the barbarian. The character that Katsumoto plays is more ambivalent. It was indeed many of the samurai daimyos who helped reinstall the emperor and, in fact, welcomed the West, only to discover that they had a very mixed blessing that they were bringing. The coming of the West ended the samurai's role. They had been Japan's protectors. They had been the people who had fought her wars. And their obsolescence was revealed in the coming of the great ships. The two actors in this scene, the woman, her name is Koyuki, Koyuki Kato. She goes by the single name of Koyuki. And the young man, his name is Shin Koyamada. Koyuki had first, as many actresses begin in Japan, begun as a model. She had done one small film and a little bit of television. I met hundreds of actresses, but no one seemed possessed of the kind of feel of old Japan as Koyuki. She's has something quite beautiful and also melancholy. Her gestures, her hand gestures, her movements are so beautiful. And Shin is a wonderful martial artist. He'd never acted before, but he had a lovely spirit and a boyishness that I thought was appropriate. Now here, you know, this is something that you know, risks cliche, the idea of DTs and the idea of a kind of going to the bottom. But we felt it was as if we had to almost burn out this nightmare. Here again, the door is closed on him. Kind of theme. Initially, in the script, she actually went to him. And as we put this together, we realized that, in fact, it's her willingness not to go to him that is the more significant gesture. So we cut the part of him for actually going in there. The image of the Buddha was obviously important in terms of his faith. And the Buddha, we see it in the form several different moments in the piece. I thought it would be interesting to show someone like this, like the Kerry Walker, and actually looking at a Buddha for the first time, trying to understand what that is. There's something quite odd. You'll notice we've kept him entirely inside until this moment. We wanted the discovery of the village to be subjective. That as he walks out into the village and as he sees it, we see it for the first time. And not just about him seeing it, but these people seeing him. And so, as he meets this man who's following him, soon to be understood to be his guardian. The man playing his guardian, his name is Seizo Fukumoto. He had been in samurai films for 40 years. As he describes himself, he's always the guy, the third man to get killed in any group scene. He'd never had a featured part. He'd been in every great movie. And this was just one of those coincidences in which, because I didn't have the preconceptions as to who should play what, when I met him and saw his face, I just fell in love with the face and felt that this would be a wonderful feel to have in the movie somebody who actually carried the history on his face. He turns out to be a lovely man, and he was going to retire at the end of this film. He's 70, and I've actually just heard that he's decided to perhaps do it for a few more years now based on the new celebrity he suddenly received because of the film. The men riding by are doing yabusame, which is still popular in Japan. Now, this is Shun Sagata, playing character of Nakao. And the idea of Aikido is something that was beginning to be introduced at this time, I think, from Okinawa. And we wanted to show that as well. But the idea of the character here now seeing the armor is obviously the next piece in the ghost story. Why is the armor in this house? Why is the boy kneeling in front of it? And as he walks into this place, this beautiful wood house with his muddy boots, I think I'm probably telling my own story as well. There are very few of us who've gone to Japan and not committed some grievous faux pas in some situation like this. Here again, what John Toll and I did with Lily Kilvert is we designed a set where we could shoot the interiors during the morning with a harsh light, and we could shoot these splendid exteriors only at the end of the day. And so the only way you get shots like this is to shoot literally between 6 and 8 at night in the middle of the summer, where this light is just so sublime. But we wanted the village to be a place that was a beauty of the 19th century Japanese imagination, that it somehow spoke of something so precious and so fleeting. And the only way to do that was to photograph it in its most beautiful way possible. Now we're back in Engyoji, back in Japan itself, for the scene where Algren Fritz meets Katsumoto. I suppose it's time to begin to talk about Ken Watanabe. I had met, again, many, many, many Japanese actors, all of them wonderfully talented, but none of them possessed of those qualities of soulfulness, of wit, and of power that I needed. And then Ken walked in the room, and it was as if I could feel my heart and my respiratory rate just slow down, because he seemed to have all of it and so much more. He has some English. He's a brilliant man. He applied himself to the study of the language, not just phonetically, but literally understanding each word and each nuance. Yoko Narahashi worked with him very closely on each scene. But the idea was a man who had lived fundamentally alone in his leadership, and who discovers in this other man, for the first time in his life, someone who perhaps could understand what he's talking about. As if their two experiences as warriors had some commonality of interest, some shared experience. And what they discover is each in the other.
The same is true of yours. For example, not to introduce yourself is considered...
It's hard to talk about a performance that's as wonderful as Ken's. The only thing to say is that I think he knew in some fundamental way that the images of Japanese actors that have been perpetuated in the last 20 years have tended to be two-dimensional at best and often caricaturish. And that in this movie he was representing something, even signifying something, to the world that would see this film, because it's a Tom Cruise movie, because it's a big movie, that he was inhabited by a spirit of something that is central to the Japanese culture and to its myths and to its traditions, which is the spirit of samurai. And the spirit of samurai, of course, is something that has informed Japanese film since its inception, but also Japanese business, Japanese sports. It's one of the central myths, as we have the myth of the Western hero, the lone man on the plains. It may not have been entirely true, but it's even more true for its uses as a myth. And now for the first time the door is opened, and he's invited in. I think Tom's work in the scene is particularly good, because he's just learned that this person next to him is serving him in this lovely way is indeed the widow of someone whom he's killed. And her proximity to him as she leans in and gives him the dishes makes him even more desperately uncomfortable.
Close up.
So now, having been invited generously, he feels even more alienated. These children were quite extraordinary, and the little boy plays Magojiro, Aoi Minato. Was this remarkable child, and what he does here is something that I never have ever dreamed of trying to show a child to do, but having seen him do it, I immediately seized on it and had him do it again and again and made it part of the scene. I love the incongruity of this child expressing the thing that no one else is willing to express, which is their extraordinary rage at him being there amidst the politeness. Now we go to a kind of set piece, which is Algren's, the beginning of his training with a very hard teacher. The character of Ujo, played by Hiroyuki Sanada, maybe a good time to spend a word or two talking about him. He is really the closest thing to a Tom Cruise in Japan. This is not this gentleman here, this is Shin. Again, Hiro is about to come. I'll pause for a moment to just talk about this. This is the idea that the boy would have this opportunity to actually attack him, to express some of his feelings, was the reason for the sort of beginning of the scene, also to find a way to put a wooden kendo stick into Algren's hands to then offend the character of Ujo now as he appears. But Sanada-san is a man who, by rights and by the traditions by which people are often cast in Japan, might well have played Katsumoto. He's done the leads in many movies. He's beloved as an actor. He sings, he dances, he's played the fool and Lear. There's nothing you really can't do, and he's also a great martial artist. But when I chose to put Ken in that role, he said, "I am willing to do whatever you need me to do in this movie. I want to be part of it. I believe in what it says about our culture. I believe in making a movie that is a fusion of an American sensibility and a Japanese sensibility, and you tell me and I'll do it." And so I cast him very much against type, as Ujo, as the swordmaster, as the lieutenant, as a ferocious, even cruel man. And of course he does it magnificently. And the scene here, it's not just the choreography, but the risk here, as they're in the rain, swinging these things at each other, with a muddy, uneven floor. And that's a wonderful moment there where he stops just short of Tom, and Tom takes that hit as if both of them were the most accomplished stuntmen. There's no CG there. Those are real sticks being swung at real speed. And this is Tom, on the ground, in the rain, hours and hours and hours, freezing almost hypothermic with this weather, saying, "Did we get it?" And I'd say, "Well, yes." He'd say, "You mean we didn't get all of it?" I said, "Well, we could probably cut it together." He goes, "No, let's do it again. Let's just do it until we get it right." And here he goes, knocked to his ass again, taking that fall again and again, face in the dirt. I think the only reason this movie works, if it works at all, is his willingness to not be the brilliant white leader showing something, but rather being more of the humiliated pupil. It's also by Hans Zimmer the introduction of a very important musical theme in the movie, which is very strong and finds its application several times in the film. Hans's work is so deeply personal and felt too. I think he believed he had to live each scene as completely as the actors who had done it or we who had written it or directed it in order to find its sound.
I just realized
it's a deliberate choice of the movie to now have a comic moment following a dramatic one to try to leaven those moments. It's a personal theory that there's no movie that can be funny enough, even in the midst of the most dramatic circumstance. I think it allows an audience to breathe and to feel in good hands, and even to be open then to the next dramatic moment rather than having been bludgeoned with it. Here we are back in Gyoji. These scenes that Tom and Ken do were some of the first we shot in the picture. So it was very taxing on him because, you know, his English grew stronger and stronger, but to do these scenes early was a huge challenge, and to do more than one scene a day sometimes when it's not your language is a remarkable accomplishment on Ken's part. We rehearsed, though, in a very traditional way. We worked on character, we worked on staging, we spent a week in a rehearsal room with Tom and Ken and with Hiro Sanada and Koyuki and all of them. And without that, I think we never would have been able to do this early in the movie. But here's where you begin to see Ken's wit, when he begins to talk about Custer. And, you know, it's a very difficult thing to... It's hard enough to act in another language, but to have some irony and some sophistication in your performance is really the accomplishment of his understanding of our intentions.
Don't you have a rebellion to lead?
People in your country do not like composition.
He was a lieutenant colonel. His name was Custer.
I know this name. He killed many warriors.
Oh, yes. Many.
I think the evocation of Custer here again is it's quite deliberate. The idea that this specter of this one leader now somehow is reflected in this other one that he meets.
How many men for Custer?
211.
I like the General Custer.
He was a murderer.
That does happen to be one of my favorite lines in the film when he says, "I like this General Custer."
Troopers died for it.
I think.
And there's a lovely thing that Ken does coming up here when he goes and sits after Tom yells at him and after Seizo comes in, when he says, "Good day, Captain," as if he's, you know, making a little point of poking fun at Tom's lower rank, that he indeed is not a general. But most of all, when he says, "In spring the snows will melt and the passes will open," I think he's preparing us for what is to come in this act, that this man who has never stood still, this man who has never sat, is now going to have to sit. And the heart of Zen, of Zazen, is sitting. And the idea that this man, who's never been able to be still, might have to confront stillness and confront himself, is what the second act of the movie is about. Here's another shot, typically, that we would work like maniacs all day and then come outside to try to shoot some shot always in the final hours of dusk. That shot outside, this shot with the sword maker too. The sword maker here happens to be a national treasure. He's one of the great sword makers in Japan. He came and actually set up a kiln made by hand there on the set.
As if I were a stray dog.
The word here that the boy is, that hot pool here, it's something that Lily built quite wonderfully into the side of a hillside. You'll see how many of the exteriors now are beautiful and how could they all possibly shot at the right time of day. It's because we, Nilo Otero, the first assistant director, and Chuck Mulvihill and I, we all scheduled it in such a way as to be able to try to do it this way. That word is the samurai that he's drawing. It becomes important later on. Now, this is a part of Tom that I began to know as I got to know him, which is that he has children, and he's a wonderful father, and I traded on that shamelessly. I felt that, in fact, the first connection between him and these people would be through a child, that rather than directly, it's often the least expected way that these connections are made, and I thought that Tom's just innate connection to these children would find a beautiful way to inform his performance, and it does. Now here's Sanada-san showing the tea ceremony. Look at the grace of this. Just an image. And yet, you know, typical in the way that he was able to just, you know, show us things that we never would have been able to have done well ourselves.
I am surprised to learn that the word samurai means to serve, and that Katsumoto believes his rebellion.
These are little montage pieces that were, you know, designed deliberately to go over the letters. try to suggest passage of time. You see the images of fall and the trees all around her. This is Lily's work, not, you know, making it fall. Maybe a word about the village is worth talking about. This village was constructed during a terrible, terrible New Zealand winter. It's all constructed in the old manner, with the thatch, with the old construction, and Lily, John Toll, and I scouted for 2 weeks in a helicopter throughout the North and South Island of New Zealand to find this valley, to find a place that looked as if it was protected and beautiful and safe and would be a kind of character in the piece. Here again now, as he understands the armor and begins to feel haunted by it, we bring it back into the film. All the armor was made by hand by Nyla Dixon. Now, a terrible dramatic challenge. How do we get him into a kimono without that being something that is in some way laughable or to which the audience would be guarded? And the solution that I came up with was that we would make fun of it ourselves, that somehow his own insecurity and his own kind of a play acting here would disarm an audience's response. The funny thing is that after the fact, after he'd actually done this, there was someone who said, well, here's another moment which Tom Cruise is dancing as in Risky Business. And it's about as far from our imagination as we could have, but it's funny how these things tend to evoke one another. But it leads to this very interesting moment here, because the boy who sees it gives him a gesture of respect. And this is another step along the process of his assimilation. Here we are again outside in the village. What you can't see, of course, is there. We're up on this big ridge, and down below is the entire base camp, a universe of caravans, of tents, of hundreds of people in support vehicles, of helicopters. And we had to climb that hill every day, to and from breakfast and lunch. Equipment had to be brought up and down. And yet you had to create this perfect and bucolic pastoral world where you have no sense of all of the technical support that exists just down below, just out of shot. It's almost something that my partner Marshall Herskowitz calls anti-entropic, the idea that the entropy of life is all around you, the plains, the weather, the technical support, that you have to somehow keep that out and hold back the tide of modernity in order to create a period universe. Here now, the theme of language, or the subplot of his language beginning, and the idea that it would be hesitant and tentative and we would use some comedy to help do that is a bit of sleight of hand in the storytelling, I think. Here, Shin says the word top-knot as a word that he's learning, but that's artfully sort of composed in the screenplay by Marshall and by John Logan to set up something much later on about the top knot, part of the edicts of the cutting off of the top knot. So in the context of one scene, they're also laying pipe for another. In addition to which, we're meeting these characters and getting to know them more. In the village, in this period of time, it's no fewer than 8 relationships that we're observing. We're observing him and Taka, him and Katsumoto, him and Ujo, him and Magojiro, Higen, and the Silent Samurai. I have to say that some of the scenes in Japanese are my favorite in the movie. I think they do so well. And I think it's a pleasure, I think, for the audience to feel as if they're being let in on a secret. There's actually a moment that Ken does when his back is to us and he shrugs, and you see the weight of the world on him that he... It's a wonderful job of physical acting without words. This translation here is interesting. It is beyond my understanding. It is not a literal translation. Oftentimes we were in a very interesting situation, as if you're translating poetry. Do you go for a literal translation or do you go for the sense? And we always decided to go for the sense. I worked with a very talented Japanese screenwriter. His name is Yo Takayama for the Japanese dialogue. And he said, oh, that's what he does on his end too when he does English. He says he'll always go for the understanding of the sense rather than the literalness. It's important the audience feel what the writers intend, not understand it as if it were a course in Berlitz.
She's honored to have my guest in her house.
This shot is a real sky. That's not any kind of enhancement. It's just the kind of thing that is possible in New Zealand when you're in a beautiful place for a long period of time. As opposed to this shot, which is entirely artificial in terms of the snow. That's a beautiful graveyard, actually, of the shrines in Japan. Winter. And now we go back to New Zealand with more artificial snow.
What does it mean to be samurai? To devote yourself utterly to a set of moral principles. To seek a stillness.
The passages of the letters and the passage of time was very important because we wanted there to be a sense that he really was in this place to learn the training, to learn the language, to connect with the people. And that's what the letters are trying to accomplish there. Now there's our fake snow with some CG snow in the background as well, just to, an enhancement. This moment by Koyuki is, I think, a fulcrum in the whole piece. As she walks in and suddenly sees the connection that he's made with his children. It's all silent acting by her. It's as if it's an Erich von Stroheim character, that she does it all internally with these looks happening behind her eyes. And as she sees him now, something changes, against her will, even with some sadness. But it's as if she's beginning to accept him, at least in the home. Again, fake snow. I love the reflective surfaces of the house here that John does. You know, everything is glinting off everything else. There's great depth all around it. And yet it's all in shades of black. It's our deep browns and blacks. Letting the shadows fall off, let other ones reflect, creates a very, very evocative space. Here now you see also, in terms of John's work, his love of photographing women. There's a close-up here of Koyuki's face, and it's not that she's not a beautiful woman, but indeed there are certain aspects of her face that are difficult to photograph. But there's a shot coming right now, I think, that in which you just suddenly, as if for the first time, look inside this character and see just how beautiful she is. And it's at the same moment that Tom is actually reaching out to try to connect with her as well. And as she sees it, and you see him see her there, you, I think, are falling in love with her as he is. Also her sadness. It's also Lois Burwell and Jan Alexander. Her look is beginning to soften a little bit and allow us in. It's less opaque than the look they've been giving her up to this point. I love little technical details. The next shot of the icicle is, of course, a fake icicle with fake snow. And here we are back now in New Zealand in spring.
This marks the longest I have stayed in one place. The farm at 17.
We go from New Zealand to Japan here. And here as he walks, we see another Buddha. It's as if the Buddha and Ken's look with his shaved head, there's some evocation, each with the other.
The field of battle has led me to question God's purpose. But there is indeed something spiritual in this place.
This is her Lily's rice field that she kept desperately trying to get in the movie, and we finally were able to do one day with a second camera.
I cannot but be aware of its power.
And the idea that this character might now be able to sit as he was ever unable to do, of course, suggests the growth that he's made. I love the idea of him playing baseball, that he, you know, this was probably, actually the game of baseball had come to Japan in Tokyo at this point, and they were often playing wearing wooden sandals. That moment where she touches her hair is a quite wonderful psychological gesture, too. I think that it's this notion of her actually caring what she might look like is the next step in this silent set of relationships that's happening here. This scene, the idea of heading toward the draw, is very important because The idea of them betting wasn't in the script, and the scene really wasn't working without it. I went and shot the scene with the draw, and I looked and I went, oh, God, it's so straightforward. What would happen if we were trying to develop a little subplot here on the side of the other samurai betting? And suddenly the scene came alive to be able to cut back and forth between them. And he gave it a little comic flourish, and also I think it made it take place in a context as if, you know, they were all observing it, and this is something that had been going on before. I guess it came out of reading about how much samurai loved to gamble, too. And now we go into the sort of slowed down, you know, it's a very oversimplification of the Zen notion of playing out of your mind, of being outside of your body, of, you know, saying that the baseball players talk about, I could see the pitch so well, I could see the rotation on the ball. The idea that you stop thinking and only participate fully in the moment, and that might be part not just of sports, but also of martial arts. Many years ago when I took some martial arts, I sparred, actually, and did some sparring for about a year until I broke 3 ribs by walking into a punch with a man who was a black belt that pulled his punch, and I was unable to stop, and that ended my sparring career. I also felt that the pre-visualizing was something that also athletes have always talked about, the idea that the night before you would see a thing, and that he might, in his concentration, already be anticipating a certain number of moves. Was something that I thought was a way of actually filming something that otherwise had been an internal process. Now, this moment, him having reached one moment of a draw with his master swordsman, anticipates the next thing that's going to happen, because having completed that training, it becomes more plausible that he's able to actually pick up a katana and protect himself. So that in the next scene that happens, when the ninja attack, he's still in a rough form, but nonetheless doing something that we've never seen him do before. This play here, by the way, is called Kyogen. It's a very traditional native Japanese form of theater, and it was just a flourish that John, Logan, and Marshall and I sort of came up with it, that Katsumoto himself would take a part of buffoonery. And I love Ken as he does it. It's a very, you know, delicious kind of aping of himself that he's doing there. Initially, this attack with the assassins took place in an inn, as they were already traveling to see the emperor, and we realized that, first of all, we couldn't afford to build the inn, we were already so far over budget, and we realized that an attack on the village itself would be a kind of defilement of this place we'd come to love, one of those moments in which an economy actually becomes important narratively. You know, this is the kind of sequence which is hugely difficult, because you're choreographing lots of people and a lot of fights and a whole different narrative that takes place at 3 separate times, and you're shooting it all at night, all night long, for a couple of weeks, and trying to keep your stamina, keep your focus, and understand the demands, the obligations of every shot and every movement is a huge intellectual exercise. We storyboarded all of it, and of course what happens is you storyboard it as an intellectual exercise and then end up throwing away half the storyboards, because when you get there on the day, none of it conforms to what your plans were. But I wanted to show something very different than the fight that we had shown. This would be kind of very savage, almost frenzied, out of control hand-to-hand combat that we hadn't yet seen, where you know, these two forces sort of almost evenly matched are just, you know, tearing the hell out of each other. We take some license here. It's, you know, no one really knows whether ninjutsu really existed, whether there were assassins who had these weapons in this training. Some say yes, some say no. But we knew it would make a great sequence and become very important narratively. I think the key to any kind of an action piece in a movie like this is not that it exists independent as a kind of tour de force, but rather that it becomes revealing of character. And the idea that Algren and Katsumoto here end up fighting side by side is the whole intent of the sequence, that he picks up a sword to defend this place that intuitively he's come to love, and in doing so becomes bonded with this figure of Katsumoto in a way that he never could have anticipated. He's fighting to protect something with a visceral protection and a kind of a inadvertently taking the role of husband and father in a way that he never might have imagined. And yet once done, something has been cemented. Now here again, these are very difficult stunts that Tom is doing all himself as he's being, you know, kicked backwards over his things and thrown here and there. You know, the training that he did was quite remarkable, and his willingness to go every day and to get up after being bruised and battered was really pretty unique in my experience. There again, the story comes into play as narrative. The boy picks up his father's sword. The character of Algren has to now act in defense of the boy whom he's connected to. And suddenly it's not an action sequence, but rather it's a scene in which something is happening in the drama. And at this moment, now Katsumoto has two at him. At this moment, suddenly Algren appears, and suddenly they are now fighting together for the first time. So that something, again, narrative has happened that anticipates the rest of the movie. Now here's a moment actually coming up right, not yet, as these other men come in, as they fight, right here, as Tom steps underneath Ken's swing, right there. That is about as dangerous a stunt as anyone will ever do, and that's Tom and Ken doing it themselves. Because they're going full out, and sometimes the adrenaline takes over, and people don't necessarily remember the speeds at which they've been practicing, and that's when people get hurt. I do like the cut here from the frenzy to the stillness. We're back in Japan here now. This is a graveyard where 900 years of ancestors have been buried at this monastery. Some of the cherry trees are real, but we put the blossoms in there because, of course, we weren't shooting in spring at this point. The idea that Katsumoto is a poet was, again, an attempt to talk about the fact that samurai was not just about a warrior culture, but was also about an aesthetic and an art, poetry.
Was it the emperor?
Most of all, philosophy.
Omura?
If the emperor. You know, it's the choice of the movie to celebrate one aspect of the samurai. Of course, we know that they were an aristocratic culture that thrived on the burden was placed on the peasants, not unlike the chivalric culture of King Arthur and the romanticization of the Round Table. But to choose to celebrate those aspects of their lives, the philosophy, the idea of life in every breath, was for the sake of, I think, the deepest and most important wellspring of their contributions to Japanese culture to an audience that had never really known much about it.
I don't want that.
Meaning a popular audience of 17-year-olds.
You have seen.
This conversation is interesting. There are ways in which it was the most obviously on-the-nose philosophical conversation, and yet the key to making it work was to try to make it about their friendship, about the coming together of these two men.
I don't remember like this person.
When Ken talks about death, it is something that he has, in his own life, understood. He was very sick at one point in his life and almost died. And I think each day that he now is alive is really understood to be a gift. And there was at times what seemed to be a death sentence hanging over his head. And so when he talks about these issues of death and life, the soulfulness and the very specific weight of it comes from a very personal place. And I think that informs his performance in a very beautiful way, too.
Good.
He lets it into the piece, not in a sentimental way, but just in a very real way.
When I took this, you were...
Here again, the notebook, the bag appears, and something has happened between these two men. It's remarkable how, in a movie where you've seen no nudity or anything at all provocative, how you see a woman's arm and her shoulder, how deeply sensual and attractive that can be, and certainly, you know, she has a very unique grace. But the idea that this movie seems to be about people actually dressing rather than getting undressed is almost unconsciously thematic, I think. Here again, their relationship takes place in such few words. He doesn't have much Japanese. All he says is, I must go away. And the whole relationship exists in this sort of mute exchange of looks. And here again, a bow means something entirely different. This next shot coming up is almost classically Western, as the rider gets on his horse to leave and the little boy comes toward him. It evokes Shane or something to me. This boy offering this token to this man. And I like Tom's work here. He doesn't become sentimental in his looking at it. He doesn't give the kid a lot. He's resisting it. I think that's proper. But as the writers now come forward, we know that the second act of the movie is over. And we're about to head into the next chapter of the film. But he stays in his horse for a moment. He even lets his horse wheel. He's looking for her. She's not there. Not there to say goodbye. And finally, he goes. And as we cut inside, this is a comp shot. We never could have really accomplished this, really, to have that kind of balance with interior and exterior light. And so we did that actually in two passes. We now go back to Tokyo, which is done in Burbank on the New York street, where, you know, every 40s musical and God knows what Humphrey Bogart movies and whatever else was done. And we've now made it into Tokyo of 1876. The work by Lily Kilbert, by Gretchen Rao, by the painters and designers is just remarkable here. And, you know, as they come forward now on the street, Hans's score expresses the samurai theme in a full-bodied voice, and it's the time now when it all comes together, and you'll hear it as it then repeats itself later in the battle. It's sort of the sound of it, of he and the samurai now joining together. I love the wires, the telegraph wires crisscrossing everywhere. It's the image of the creeping new and technological coming into this old place. If ever images can tell the story without words, the idea of these Westerners standing next to these traditional Japanese, then something's happening, you know, and a tension is on the screen that needn't ever be described any other way. And now we see the howitzers. We're back at the parade ground in New Plymouth. That's a mat in the distance, and those are some real soldiers. As we move them around and duplicated to them, they're all real, but we shot them at several different times and then with a lock-off camera just made it look to be, you know, 3,000 when indeed it may have only been 500.
Ogren, my God, you are alive.
And as we see Tony Goldwyn again, this lieutenant, this character is actually very important. That was a little pickup shot I realized to add a close-up of the lieutenant into this shot because we've seen him in the battle in the fog, we've seen him again now. He becomes very important at the end of the movie. But we introduce the Gatling guns. And the Gatling gun is the ultimate vessel of modern destruction. And as Algren looks at them, you know, he's looking at something that he doesn't yet know to be his future.
Welcome back, Captain.
These shots are, that's the actual real Imperial Palace in Tokyo. That's a little place in Kyushu. And now we're at a temple in Kyoto, all together trying to create one place. These costumes are quite beautiful. They're based on a man named Sengoku-san's family who has clothed the Imperial household for many generations. He took Nyla Dixon and I into his workroom, and through the many months that Nyla spent going back and forth to Tokyo, she was able to base all of her designs on, you know, historically true and accurate costumes.
Yeah.
I like particularly the sort of wisteria hanging down in the background there. That's all, again, false, but, you know, based on what would have been true. Now the Meiji has grown a beard and looks very much like the emperor came to look, actually, at this moment in history. The subplot of Katsumoto and the Meiji is as important to the Japanese who have read the script and who have participated in the movie as anything in the movie. The idea of the relationship between Katsumoto and this emperor, that he then is refused by the emperor and then Algren brings a sword, is a scene that they feel honors history and in a way that's very important to them. Now we're in Omura's office, which is done as a whole European office, which is deliberate, with a Caravaggio behind him, actually, all dark wood and brass and lacquer.
He spent the entire winter at his encampment
as his prisoner.
I think you can see in the scene, by this scene, that Harada-san is becoming much more comfortable with his performance style, and he even adds a few flourishes that are very nice. Just an interesting parenthetical. That's Scott Wilson playing the part of Swanbeck. He's a wonderful actor, has a great career. He agreed to do the small part for us. He was one of the leads in the Richard Brooks film In Cold Blood.
Someone else we should be speaking to.
With all due respect, Ambassador, perhaps there is someone else we should be speaking to. For instance, the French or the English. Why any of the delegations waiting in the next room?
Yes. Well, we should be looking forward to hearing from you.
Good afternoon, gentlemen.
You'll notice that so many of the walls and things that we've created in the sets that Lily and John have come up with are all dark, so as to set off the portraiture and create that period feel in the faces of these faces against dark spaces. Here he offers him a drink, and Algren says no, which is, again, a subtle but I think crucial moment in the character's development.
Katsumoto is an extraordinary man, is he not?
He's a tribal.
Again, Tom's work here is very spare, very simple, but as you look in his eyes, as Arada-san is talking to him, you see what's going on that he's thinking and not saying, which I think really is the heart of the scene.
You are right, Captain Algren. Last year, we are not prepared to go to battle. You are right, and Colonel Bagri was wrong. But now we are ready. If Katsumoto is allowed to attract other samurai to his cause, we will have 10 years of...
It's as if the character has gained some new stillness, which we hadn't seen in his performance before. I also think in some measure it's Tom, his response to working with some of the Japanese actors, like Katsumoto and like Koyuki, where he's actually internalized some of their stillness and has brought it into his character, into his performance, as he spent time with them. I think it's something he thought about a lot.
Was to train your army.
Then we will make a new contract. One that will recognize the extraordinary contribution you have made to the Emperor. Do we understand each other?
Yes, we understand each other perfectly.
Then I'm pleased.
And now we go back out onto the street for a dramatization of one of the very important moments of Japanese history at this time, which was the edicts against the samurai, in which they were no longer permitted to wear swords, which were in fact the most important symbol and tool of the culture, and no longer allowed to wear the traditional topknot. And this was enforced in a very harsh way. And for the samurai to cut off his topknot was the utter capitulation and the end of some sign of real pride. So that in this scene, when you see them force him to cut off the top knot. It evokes, to me, it evokes almost, you know, images of all sorts of other cultural depredations that I've seen pictures of in different societies over history, in which, you know, the use of force has been imposed by one group at the humiliation of another. Even the notion that he would sheath his sword there and allow it to be taken is the ultimate shame.
Lanka!
It's a moment where Hans's score is very beautiful now and is playing the internal anguish as well. Here, as Algren picks him up to go, we introduce those characters. We've already seen one of them, the man with the sort of rouge, the wine, port wine stain in his face, birthmark that, which by the way is also fake, to identify him. These men are those who are going to eventually fight Algren in a sequence not... long after. Here we tried to take a traditional imperial palace type of set and change it, give it a more modern context. Suddenly there are men at desks, sitting in chairs, smoking cigarettes, so that the modern has crept its way into this older, traditional setting. And Katsumoto enters wearing his traditional kimono and carrying the swords, which is the provocation. We saw many pictures of what these councils looked like. There are some great faces here. The extras casting was very good. And again, Nyla's various uniforms, the military uniforms, the naval uniforms, the politicians' uniforms, the retainers. It's just a huge, huge job. And this moment, when Katsumoto steps forward to offer his sword to the emperor, always evokes something to me of Falstaff and Henry V, that he's denied by this young man who had been his pupil. And Nakamura-san does very well here in his performance, I think. Ken and I had many conversations as to whether or not he would dare meet the emperor's eye, and... I think he ended up at a place just off it, but his internalization of this moment is just a beautiful piece of acting. The combination of rage, surrender, shame, resignation. He has this habit of leaving quickly, of just turning with a flourish to go and then stopping. Again, a very different kind of a bow at this moment between him and the emperor. Now you see Algren unloading the gun, putting the gun away, preparing to leave.
Omura offers you my job and you run away.
Tony Goldman's part is really very, very tricky because, you know, it would be so easy to make this a kind of, again, mustache-twirling villain. I think what he chooses to do is to make him a man of his time, a man who genuinely believes in the superiority of his race, of his obligations, and of the... guarantee of his future.
Pretty much over. Katsumoto's under arrest. Omura won't let him last the night. And if Katsumoto's dead, we should have
is utterly and legitimately perplexed by a character such as Algren, by his ambivalences, by his uncertainties.
Especially without you.
Now he picks up the drawing that was drawn by the little boy that says the word samurai. I never felt it necessary to subtitle this. I thought it didn't matter if the audience knows it or not. I think they'll intuitively understand what this is. And here we begin this sort of fulfillment of the psychic connection of Katsumoto's prophecy of Algren, and to suggest that in fact it's now flowing in two directions, that his awareness of Katsumoto having the possibility of his death being evoked is something that he just can't abide. And this is the moment in which Algren makes that final commitment to what he intuitively had already felt. And here, as Katsumoto looks at the tanto, at the knife, Algren then decides to go after him. And we're setting up a moment in which now, Algren, having made this decision to essentially side with Katsumoto to go rescue him, it's as if his apotheosis in the spirit of Bushido is complete, and we find a way, in the context of an action sequence, to physicalize that, to dramatize it. It's a remarkable thing that Tom does here. It's a set piece for which he had to learn 36 moves, all to be done in one shot, each of which is full of danger and requires great athleticism and real control. It's not just about him not getting hurt, it's about him not hurting anybody else. It was very important to us to have four men swinging at one man all at once, not to have anybody waiting to be killed, but rather what it might have been like where people were actually literally going all out at him. And so, as he flings himself into it, it's important to realize that he was doing this all himself. He did it three nights in a row, try to get all of his shots in these ways from these angles. And indeed, it was a huge accomplishment, because you should do it again, now put a wound on. Do it again, put another wound on. Do it again, you know, change the camera angle. Do it again, add blood spray. Because the idea is that he'd done something that was out of control. Now, looking back, it's as if he's trying to reflect on what's just happened. That the first time it happened without any forethought. And now, as he's just finished, he's actually trying to break it down again in his head. What did I just do? What just happened? And I suppose it's a bit of a theatrical device of trying to actually show what, you know, we've come to understand or expect in football, to see the instant replay, to have the pleasure of actually seeing something broken down and shown again and actually explored in some greater detail or delight or you know, experience of it in a more full way. It's interesting, when we show this to audiences, the idea that this character now, having disarmed a man, would show him no mercy, is completely understood, that it's not perceived to be anything cruel, but rather somehow appropriate, because those are the terms that the story has been told in. We now go back to Burbank, where we've now built Katsumoto's house. It's interesting, this scene, when Marshall and I wrote this scene, about how to get him into the palace, we thought, oh yes, There's a fear of authority, that he would try to bluster his way in. But there's a deep pool of reference that exists in all of us who are filmmakers or who have loved movies, and that really wasn't until about, I think 6 months after we shot this and we're putting this together, that I suddenly realized that there's a scene in a movie called Von Ryan's Express where Edward Mulhare, who's a priest has to imitate a Nazi officer because he speaks German, and he actually has to bluster his way past something, and it's conceivable that that was, you know, in some corner, some psychic, dusty corner of our brains that we were somehow referencing.
President of the United States?
Sorry. I think I made him sick.
Geographically now, we set up the terms. We set up the bridge. We set up the water. That all becomes part of the action sequence later. And you want to understand what the circumstances are that you then have to get out of if this is going to be indeed an escape.
How's your poem coming?
And you hadn't seen it, or hadn't noticed, but the rickshaw that was carried in had four men pulling it. Two different rickshaws carried by four different porters. And now, at this moment, that Algren then opens the door and you hear a sound, you reveal that one of the porters was indeed Lucio, and that in a moment you'll see that the other porters were Natao and Nobutada and the Silent Samurai. Again, how to afford an escape with just swords or arrows against guns. The idea of not using guns was a contrivance. The samurai certainly had used guns. Many of them had, in fact, abjured using firearms because they thought they were dishonorable. But it was a metaphorical conceit to try to talk about the old and the new. And the answer, of course, is arrows. We've seen them training in archery, and now there they are. There's no batata. Here again, we're shooting all night long, many nights. This was the first action piece in the movie that we actually shot very early in the schedule. And I actually felt I was a bit rusty at the beginning of it and wasn't really getting it well. I think I accomplished something at the end, which was maybe the most important, which is Nobutada's death, and that felt right. How does one dramatize this notion of a good death? It's important that the audience begin to understand that conceit if you're then going to accept something that happens at the end. So that was the real challenge at the end of this sequence here, is to how to actually go inside the concept of sacrifice and obligation. In the movie when he actually looks at his son and realizes that he's going to have to let him go. And very difficult for Shin, because he's not an actor. He's become an actor now. But to go to a place where he's trying to fight consciousness, trying to connect with his father, trying to say these things that are meaningful, very difficult thing for a young actor to do. But what you look and see on Ken's face, you see this extraordinary connection. This absolute, ferocity, and yet finally this surrender. Just a great piece of eternal acting. And now as they go, we see the moment of preparation and acceptance. And this glorious, horrible end. And I felt it was important that the character of Algren see it, because finally it's his education. It's his subjective experience of this that is ours. And that image of the figure on the bridge, arms displayed like that, was the one that we were really going for. That white smoke and the black figure there on the bridge. now he has seen it, and he'll never forget that. We go now to a scene where we shot the scene, John Toll and I, by real firelight. It was enhanced by some lighting. But what John discovered and came to me and pointed out was there was some halation, some distortion from the heat of the fire there in the foreground, and it was distorting the faces a bit if you look closely. And did we want to try to lower it and, you know, compensate for that? And we looked at each other and realized, no, we wanted to keep it, that it gave it a kind of otherworldly feel for this moment when they're both going inside, Katsumoto most of all, thinking about his fate. There's some deep and almost surreal quality that it lends the scene, that there's distortion in their faces. So we just left it.
Shame for life.
Sir. The thing that John understands as a cinematographer is that, yes, lighting is to be beautiful, but mostly lighting is to tell a story, and it's to reveal a character. By shading half of Tom's face in this shot, by going deep into Ken's eyes in the other, by accomplishing this deep, deep emotional feel, he's working on the performance with them.
All my enemies. And let it be your enemies.
And now we change angle to do a more direct side angle of Ken toward Tom, which is as if now let into his face as he looks at him as if for the first time. Here again, another shot at Magic Hour, scrambling to be there as we're losing the light, as we cut from the valley and the horseman to her. I like the other women behind her. It looks like something out of a Garcia Lorca story or something. And then this very austere staging, where they're all sitting in tatami position, and each in their separate planes, not really looking at one another, I felt was, I don't know how it happened or why it happened, it just somehow was as if just where they had sat when he walked in to tell them the news about Nobutada's death. And Tom's Japanese accent here is quite remarkably good. Sanada-san worked with him hours and hours, and then even came to the dubbing stage to redo a couple of words to make it as best as he could. It's a very difficult set of shadings, and I think when the Japanese have heard this film and heard him speak it, I think they're quite astonished that it actually sounds much better than most English speakers who first begin speaking Japanese. Here is a scene that we actually decided that would be beautiful to shoot again at Magic Hour, and we shot half the scene one day between about 7:30 and 8:12 at night, and the other half of the scene again the same time the next night. And what's particularly difficult is for this extraordinarily talented young boy playing Higen, for him to find this emotion and to do it take one and take two, because there wouldn't be time for take three, and he just did it every time. The recognition that there is such emotional availability on the part of the Japanese actors was something that I was so delighted to discover, because I think, again, one's expectations are informed by a certain ignorance, and there's been a certain opaque depiction of Japanese characters in films before this, and even in the stereotypes, and then to discover just how available and accessible and willing they were as a group was this remarkable gift. Here again, just the way Tom holds him, you just sense he became very fond of this boy, and he you see that he's held many a child before.
I take 2 full regiments. They'll come in waves of 1,000.
We're in a beautiful spot in New Zealand here. These are these gorgeous ridges that seem to recede to eternity that they have in many places. This is on the way out past New Plymouth. I think it's called the Uriti Valley.
There was once a battle at a place called Thermopylae.
There's so much wind in this movie. I love it. We could never possibly brought up Ritters to a place like this or half the places where there's wind, and yet there is so much wind in the country that it just gives something to a lot of these scenes that they wouldn't otherwise have. You know, there's something that feels quite epic about wind, and, you know, it's so often used in, you know, photo shoots and the like, but this was real, and it's there scene after scene.
Close enough for a sword.
You believe the man can change his destiny?
I think a man does what he can until his destiny is revealed.
And now we begin the final sequence, the preparation for the battle and the battle itself. You know, we don't know quite what these things are. You see these bamboo, you see the swords, you see these, you see the maps, you see these balls of something being covered with pitch, but you don't know what their use is going to be. But I think that sort of sets an expectation in the audience. I love the fact that he then takes more pictures of the samurai. And here's the final completion of the sword by that swordmaster, and the sword itself that you've been seeing, having been created this entire time in the background, now will become important to the end of the sequence. And Sanada-san is doing a very ritualized, a kind of a dance of death, I think, as Katsumoto gives his prayer beads to Higen. And here we just let the images work for themselves and let Hans's music carry it. I think a movie's really working best when there's no need for words. I think the more films I do, the less dialogue I like to have. And here is the final evocation of these themes of doors opening and closing as he sees her behind this door. As they look at each other, I think it's playing with a set of expectations that this would be the moment of some love scene. And instead, they observe the decorum and the distance, and she closes the door once more. Here again, just an opportunity to feel the various people in that last morning. He's still at prayer. Algren's lying awake. And as he gets up to go, he looks.
Algren-san.
And the door's open. He walks in. And we head toward the completion of that ghost story. That gesture there, as she just smooths the little kimono beneath her knee, is so beautiful and so telling. So she offers him to wear the armor, in some sense to take up the mantle of the man that he has replaced. And this was John Logan's idea, the idea that her dressing him in the armor would be the love scene, rather than some kind of expression of something that wouldn't be true, that would be inappropriate and even exploitative, that instead we would do something that is so true to the culture, the idea of one person dressing someone else in a kimono, that that would have in it all of the feeling, all of the sadness, and all of the connection between them, and would be an opportunity to do a very different kind of a love scene that was respectful of the period, of the culture, and of the obstacles between these two people. And she has real natural grace in her movements, in her gestures. And I think for Tom, the character of Algren, I think that it's very interesting to explore male passivity in a sequence like this, because so often in a love scene, it's a kind of, you know, quite the opposite of undressing and sort of... And we talked long whether they would kiss or not. Finally, we came up with the notion that the kiss would be in some way forbidden, that it would happen almost involuntarily, and that she would shrink from it, pull away from it. Something is acknowledged, and yet not really explored. And that the sadness that informs the whole scene is what would finally be the thing that is arrived at. And she would allow it to flower only at the end like that. While outside, we see the final fulfillment of the sword maker and the sword. And as Algren emerges, the ghost story is complete. He's now wearing that armor.
Okay.
Which is setting up the conclusion of the relationship with Ujo as he just looks at him in that armor.
You will need this.
Endless conversations about how these words should be written.
What does it say?
How they might be imagined
the warrior,
in the sword.
The ways have joined anew.
And we begin the movement toward the final battle. As they ride out of this village. I have to say that there was a moment when they're riding downhill here that one of the riders actually slipped and fell off. He was fine, but it was a bit scary. I love this image, though, as we see the dust as it's kicked up by the horses, and you see these men running through it. It looks very much like those samurai movies that I'd always loved. And here again, we use some duplication here. We have a lot of men here, but then we get to the wide shot. We double them so as to make it seem like many more. They're all real, but we just use them several times here again in this shot. The idea was to again set up a geography of a battle in which there was no apparent possibility of men with swords and arrows fighting against men with repeating rifles, with howitzers. And the whole narrative challenge of the piece is to try to accomplish that and, you know, fulfill the prophecy that they make when they talk about Thermopylae, that just a few warriors had held off a huge army and made them pay so dearly. The idea that they are sending a message with their inevitable death rather than just some kind of blind, suicidal gesture.
I'll look for you on the field.
You know, it's funny, I've now spent this entire commentary and have not even mentioned Steve Rosenblum. And Steve Rosenblum, the editor, and I have been friends and collaborators for 25 years. In many ways, so much of this movie is his triumph, certainly this battle is, that he's cut everything since I was a student. We kept my student film and all the television and all the movies. And in fact, he has sort of set the standard for a kind of action cutting. He's often called in now to help other movies that are in trouble. But in this case, the creation of tension, the real brilliant classical editing of rhythm and anticipation and then action is really his triumph. But it goes beyond just a facility of editing. He really is a storyteller, as sophisticated a storyteller as many screenwriters that I know, certainly as John Toll is, and that you know, it's the shape of the whole movie and not just the individual cut for cut that's his real triumph. I should go into a moment here as they're waiting for the next sequence, for the next beat to begin. That's almost like, you know, kind of Eisenstein. It's just cut, 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 cut to tempo. And we had a temporary bit of Hans's track that we cut to, and then Hans then scored it back to the same tempo. These are the cuts here, I think. There. Something we rarely do, which is cutting on the beat, you know. Now, the preparation for the final battle, again, was Saturday at the end of a work week, an entire day spent every night, often after shooting, storyboards, preparation of a whole field full of wired to put explosions, to prepare for smoke, to dig pits for horses to fall in, to be able to actually devise an entire infrastructure of roads. The man who was the unit production manager was a man named Kevin Delanoy, who had done Saving Private Ryan, is a brilliant logistician in his own right. How to get the extras to and from the set, how to feed them, how to get them water, how to, you know, help them in and out of wardrobe. It was an enormous undertaking, the final battle. It was 31 days of filming. It was trying to match that light over all 31 days, trying to have a continuity of action, to try to maintain safety, to try to maintain the sense of urgency in every shot, in every gesture. It also took advantage of a lot of visual effects. I haven't even mentioned Jeff Oken and the visual effects of the film. We, at the most, had 500 people in the sequence, and in fact, the sequence looks as if it has many, many thousand, and that is his accomplishment, understanding how to tile shots, which is taking men, moving them from one place to the next, thinking what we could steal to duplicate later in post-production, and at all times him standing next to me talking about what I was trying to accomplish and how we can best accomplish it using any variety of different techniques. There again, we had sent a few men marching across the field. We did it several times, and then Jeff used those elements to combine to create that shot. Also, it's, talking about Nick Powell and the training and the work of these stuntmen, that they had to learn so many different routines to be able to keep this background action going and to keep it, it wasn't just the foreground action of the work with Tom and Ken and Sonata, but the principles, but also the creation of real background action that gives a kind of desperation to the whole scene that I think actually lends something authentic to the principles action that happens happening in the foreground of it. Again, there's so many visual effect shots, the continuity of smoke, the doubling of actors, when arrows are tracked in and tracked out, painted in, painted out, when swords pierce people, kind of things that can't really take place. And the person finally to mention as well is Paul Lombardi, who is the person with the special floor effects, whose charges going off, whose explosions going off, whose fog in the battle, whose smoke is real. It's the blending of Paul's work with Jeff's work, with John's work, and Lily's work that creates the overall effect, and everyone has to, you know, be in coordination with each other to try to do something at this scale. And there's the payoff of those, you know, sort of flaming balls and the use of fire. In the background, some of the men fleeing. There are some CG men in the distance in some of these shots, and in that shot in particular, those guys flying up the hillside, some of those I think are actually CG. They're so small and so vague that you don't really think about it. They're just filling in the frame.
What on earth?
What is happening?
The whole notion of the final battle was to try to create a circumstance in which the audience might have a set of expectations that, like movies of old, that they might somehow survive, that they would invest in the possibility of success, because that would make the heartbreak all the greater when indeed it fails. Here again, you've got arrows that are tracked into frame, and some of them painted out and then painted back in. The rain of arrows. Duplicates in the air. Painted in, painted out.
The attack has been stopped.
Send in the rest of the regiment.
And we head toward a moment when we pay off a little comment about the Battle of Thermopylae, and we send as many men as we have all charging at one another. My heart is in my throat as the possibility of risk to your movie star and your principals and anybody out there really grows. The more people you have out there running full tilt at each other, the greater possibility of some calamity. So I think this is one of those incredibly tense moments you'll see as we go to a shot where they're all literally going full tilt boogie at one another. Like that. Six cameras, stunts, swinging swords, and movie stars. And now we're into just a choreography of action where each moment is indeed imagined, but not necessarily in the order in which they're going to be used. It was created, certain things are in sequence, and other things were just, would be known that Stevie and I would work together to create the flow. Here, again, this is a little sequence as Bob sees Algren about to be shot, puts himself in front of him. There are little dramas within it, but otherwise, there's also a certain amount of action that is just done as a kind of ND bits of action. How does a sword triumph over a gun? How does a gun overcome a sword? There again, that's an effect with just a little makeup effect that then Jeff Oaken enhanced. I mean, you know, the work that Mark Steckenshire did and Andy Nelson, it's, you know, each sword hit should be different than all the other sword hit. They should be, they should have a vividness and a distinctive sound so it's not redundant. Here again, you've got the sense of a tide of a scene where the tide is turning and now you're trying to introduce the next bit, which are the, you know, Ujio coming. And, you know, every variety that I could think of how to do a different kind of an attack, a different kind of defense, a different kind of a death. I would lie awake at night in the nights before shooting and come up with different ways to try to injure people. This is very difficult to do what we're doing now. A horse is charging into men. You're going to see that again in a moment as they go toward them and hit people as people go falling. Now here you see Hiroyuki Sanada in all of his glory, just magnificently doing this sort of martial arts and this choreography that he actually worked with Nick Powell to come up with. It's quite splendid. This is some men rolling on horses. Now there's a tiling shot, of course. We could never have had that many men. But we figured if we kept it on there briefly enough, it might actually work. We're intercutting real motion and slow motion in all of this. Now, here are Tom and Ken now fighting again side by side. And the idea that it would become, again, subjective to Algren as he sees. as if the battle were a play itself. You had the first act where they were preparing to get ready. You now have the conclusion of the second act as they've held off the first wave. And now we're getting ready for the third act. I particularly like this little imagery that's almost a little evocation of the Seven Samurai, the sword, you know, in the ground. Very lucky on this day because, having shot the whole battle, he couldn't imagine shooting this scene in sunlight, and it just would have felt so wrong. And in fact, we waited and waited and waited and just were stalling and stalling and stalling, and forced Tom and Ken to do the entire scene again in the last hour, hour and a half before dark. But it was so valuable. I think it gives a kind of imminent feel that it wouldn't have had if it were by nice, snappy blue sunlight. So they rehearsed and they rehearsed, and then it became time to shoot it. We just shot at multiple cameras and shot it very fast. Now you leave again. As if shooting a $100 million movie, as if it were a TV show.
Yes. It was not your time.
And now we prepare for the final charge. And the idea, after having shot a battle such as we shot, the question was, could we top it? And I had spent a lot of time looking at a lot of sequences from other movies of charges. There was an old movie of the charge, The Light Brigade. There was a movie called The Light Horseman. There were, you know, many other movies of charges on horseback. And in fact, they had all paled to what I wanted to accomplish. And it really was the triumph of these horsemen, Pete White and others, to really work with Paul Lombardi and the explosions and prepare. Each horse had to be trained to fall to the left or fall to the right. That they had to be comfortable working, bumping into men, working around smoke and gunfire and explosions. Many of the riders are Japanese. Many of them are Spanish, who were wearing mempos to hide their faces. And the idea that they could actually sustain a charge on camera for, you know, the minute and a half that this is done is a remarkable accomplishment. And it's also the triumph of a man named Gary Capo, who worked with us as he was really the director of the Splinter Unit, really the second unit for this particular sequence. He came in and did test after test, and was often shooting at the field next to ours so that I could participate in some of the staging, and then he would just do it again and again until he almost perfected the ways to get it right and accomplished some shots that nobody else would have thought possible, working on an insert car, working, you know, getting to know the riders and the horses, what they could do, what couldn't do, how to keep them in shot, how to keep them together. And it's a real, real accomplishment. And he was beginning to work on the sequence really for weeks before we began, just shooting test footage, trying to figure out how to get it right. I love this decision of Steve's, is to begin in slow motion and then suddenly at a particular moment to cut to real time, real speed. There. And of course, Hans picks that up with the music and does it beautifully. Tony Goldwyn is a fabulous rider, and I asked him to do very difficult things, riding out with all these men, you know, being on his horse amidst all this gunfire. I don't know what I would have done if somebody actually hadn't had that ability, because, again, I would have been forced to use a stuntman and had to hide the fact that it's Tony, and instead, well, here you have the horses. I mean, it's important to mention, of course, that not any horse was hurt, that the ASPCA was on the set the whole time, that it's some sleight of hand and some brilliant editing and some great stunt work and effects work that make it appear as if it's so horrific. The truth is the horses sort of got into it. Lot to ask Ken and Tom to do this. You know, Tom is so gung-ho, and Ken's a very good athlete too, but at a certain point, Ken got thrown once, and you know, our hearts were in our mouth as we, you know, thought of what we were risking. That fall, just to Ujo, was so difficult to combine. That was a stunt rider falling, and then Sonata taking his own fall into the shot, which was, again, very difficult. This is a little bit of CG. Tom turns the sword and throws it out of frame, and then we track the other sword into Tony Goldwyn as he's dead there. Now, these horses running through, hitting these men, is so extraordinary, because a horse doesn't want to hit a man, and these stunt guys are getting bumped and thrown all over the place, and again, who knows what that was. And here I felt that the audience would be so invested in the making it that I wanted to stretch it out and stretch it out. Here come the Gatling guns. They're charging. They're charging. He says fire, but in fact the guns aren't ready yet. And we ask ourselves, are they going to make it? Are they going to make it? The music is telling us they might. The war is going crazy. And finally, they fire. And at the moment that these guns fire, it's as if it's the end of the 19th century. This is the final evocation, the final flowering, or the last flowering of the old and the coming of the new and the brutal. That shot there is a comp shot. We did a very clever thing where horses first took falls and we put hay bales out there and had other horses jump over blue hay bales to try to combine those elements together to make that shot. Now we go back to this Japanese lieutenant. These riders were remarkable taking falls like this. I mean, just, you know, and his performance here is so crucial because he becomes the eyes of the Imperial Army and our eyes watching this. And as it goes on, it's his experience of it that we have as he's overcome by the terrible beauty and the sacrifice that he's now been party to and the slaughter. And this acting that he's doing this with just me talking him through it, and he's doing it in his head. This isn't happening. You must remember that he's looking off camera at nothing, and I'm cutting it together to create this. But that's what's brilliant about his work there. Ken's death scene is quite beautiful. We talked about it for a long time before, but on the day I barely talked to him at all, he was in a very private place, and what he was doing was so poignant and so moving that I just, I think I was smart enough to sort of get out of his way. But finally, again, it's when he talks about the conversations, it's this payoff. I did have the image always of an embrace that's also a death here. And there's something operatic about it, and something that seemed fitting to as a conclusion of the story. the idea of the men bowing and paying their respect is the other real brilliant contribution of John Logan to this screenplay. I mean, there were so many, but that in particular is a real dramatist understanding of how to encapsulate in behavior a whole cultural appreciation. And when we did it, you could feel out there everyone's awareness of just how beautiful a moment it was. It's not always that way when you're filming. Sometimes things exist in so many pieces that they don't really come together till the editing room. But in this case, as it took place, we could really feel the power of the moment. Nobody was unmoved. That shot with Tim's ball up there was shot long after. Actually, we had a different spot. We couldn't get there on the day. We knew we didn't have to, so we shot that at another hillside a week later. That's his great acting. Looking into space and remembering what he had seen. And as we go back to the throne room here, we go back to what is really, for the Japanese, maybe the most important scene in the movie. The idea that Katsumoto's death is a message sent to the Emperor, and that Algren, as the last man alive, is the one who brings it, is very important as the Emperor finds his voice. This man who's been silent, who has denied Katsumoto's request before, who has, in fact, never really taken on the mantle of his power, who now actually stands up for himself and for his country, is something that I think speaks very deeply to the Japanese and to their understanding of this moment in history. You know, it's certainly a double-edged sword in that Japan, having taken on the technology of the West and resisting the imperialist impulses that they saw in the British in Hong Kong and the Americans in the Philippines, would now create an imperial army, which then itself would become imperialist in Manchuria and Korea and on into the Second World War. But it was important for me, I think, to put that in some historical context, to suggest that it was that our relationship with Japan did not begin 60 years ago, but rather 150 years ago. And that we were also complicit in that creation. The actor Nakamura-san here does very, very well emotionally as he personalizes this moment. And Tom's gesture of kneeling and lifting the sword is the mirror of Ken's gesture earlier in the Imperial Palace.
He would have wanted you to have it. Let the strength of the samurai be with you always.
Katsumoto's death feelings are all the same. However,
he hoped.
It was a very difficult thing for Tom to do. We shot the scene very early in the schedule for him to anticipate the emotional pitch of the scene and to reach these places that when he'd not yet really gone through the whole second act or even third act of the movie, really just bespeaks his understanding and commitment emotionally to the part.
You were with him at the end?
Hi.
Emperor, this man fought against you.
There's
Your Highness.
A deep,
you believe me to be your enemy.
Romantic fantasy at the heart of this. The idea that one man can internalize some other culture. There's obviously a tradition from Conrad and Lord Jim and from Melville and Tippy and Kipling and the Man Would Be King, of the effect of the East over men from the West who've come to it, and I suppose it, in some sense, places itself in that tradition. But it also speaks to something personally to me, that at a young age, when I was very confused by the notion of death and Western culture and what its place was, that I encountered a culture in which death actually had a place rather than its denial. We here in the West, we deny that old people exist. We put them away. We dress young and are concerned always with our youth. And in the samurai credo, the notion that death would enter into life, and in an appreciation of the passing of things and the impermanence and the ephemera, that then could come an appreciation of life itself. And that became very important to me at a young moment, and I suppose somewhere deep down that was at the heart of why I wanted to make the movie. I have a 17-year-old son. He was 15 when the movie began. I think in some sense, I imagined that he might look at this movie or others like him and consider a different culture, look outside of his own, imagine that there is, you know, beauty and richness to be found elsewhere than just at home, and that he might be moved to study more, to, you know, look at this oversimplification of something that's philosophical and profound, and be compelled to look deeper.
Tell me how he died.
I'll tell you how he lived.
And as a kind of framing device, we return to our narrator and to the images that we had seen in the beginning. They're from Kyushu, which is in the southern tip of Japan, a place where those mists and the islands are as beautiful as things must once have been in the early days of Japan. It can only be found in very small corners of the real Japan now, and yet it exists always in the imagination of the Japanese and is central to their aesthetic, the place of timeless beauty and of great natural wonder. I always thought about the character of Algren as someone who is condemned to live, while Katsumoto can fulfill his destiny and die. A man who might have thought he would die, who now must actually face life.